serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes with this special Veterans Day edition, taking us back 75 years through the eyes of three men who were dealing with plenty of pain and a whole lot of uncertainty 75 years ago this week. They had all been shot out of the sky on November 2nd, 1944, in a massive mission to Merseburg and the synthetic oil factory there. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, you'll find a photo giving you a little taste of the flak-filled skies produced by 1,700 German anti-aircraft guns in Merseburg. 38 B-17s were shot down that day, another 450 damaged. We've heard from a bombardier from California and a pilot from Washington. Now let's hear from a tail gunner out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Frank Kravitz had just turned 21 a couple weeks earlier and soon would have reason to fear he might never see 22.
Well, we took off at 8 o'clock, about 8 o'clock in the morning. By the time we got rendezvoused, our poop, and got in position for this bombing stream going to our target, we flew around at different altitudes, and we're just going around and around and around, you know. And once we got to 15,000 feet, while we went on oxygen, we were getting close to France or something like that, you know, where the Germans were. And we weren't on oxygen up till then. The anticipation comes when you see the black smoke coming up, if it's flak, you know. And somebody else ahead sees that, so they're telling us, you know, enemy fire up ahead, you know. So you got over 1,000 bombers in the air, a stream going in, you know. Yeah. So unfortunately, when our pilots, they opened the bomb bay doors and get ready for attack, and that, you know, we dropped our bombs and we turned off the target. And shortly after we turned off the target, we were attacked.
When you say attacked, you're not talking about the flak anymore. You're talking about German fighters coming right at you. And you saw them? Did someone else tell you they were coming, or were you the one who saw them?
3 o'clock high. Yeah. You know, saw them coming.
How many of them?
Three abreast, you know. And I saw the cannon fire coming out of the wings for the last seconds, you know. And I fired back at them when I was still alive, you know.
And you shot one of them down?
I got credit for it. Somebody else in the other crew said that the tail gunner shot down a plane. So I have the citation for that, you know. Okay, when the second wave of planes came in, I was had my target on the planes, and all of a sudden there was an explosion in the tail end of the section, and it filled up with smoke. And of course, being at that high altitude and the holes that were in the plane and everything else, the air cleared up real quick. So there I am, realized that I was wounded. I got on my throat mic and I called to the crew pilot, tail gunner crew, I'm hit. I'm pushing on the button, the throat mic, and trying to report to him. I get no answer. As it half find out later on, this was all shot out, the whole communication system. So whenever, the only way they communicate up front, the flight engineer were hollering back into the plane as loud as they could, giving orders and what to do. They chopped out this told me just later on. They got a hatchet and chopped the ball turret out and dropped that, threw all the ammunition out. They were throwing ammunition out and everything else to lighten the plane up, you know.
Because you guys had lost three of the four engines, right?
Yeah. So this I wasn't aware of, but after our reunions and that, I was told about it. And another fellow had a video camera when we were doing it, and they all pitched in, and I had that document, which helped me write the book. They filled in the blank spaces that I, at that time, didn't know, you know. My waist gunner, we came to a crossroad going down the road towards the farmhouse, and he's got his hands over his head with a German guard with a rifle on his back, you know. And I was on a two-wheel cart that they had gotten a picket fence and put it across the two-wheel cart, and that was my stretcher. So they're marching him down, marching me down to the place, and then we come to another place, and they took him one place, and they took me to the farmhouse.
But I think maybe we missed some important details. You were wounded pretty seriously. So how'd you manage to get out of the plane?
Well, my radio operator and another fella both have me laying on the floor, and they put sulfur powder on my wound, bandaged it, and put a big compress on it. Did stop the bleeding, you know.
And this is your left thigh, and you still have shrapnel in that left thigh, right?
Over 100 pieces.
I bet you're fun to go through a metal detector with.
It was an interesting story, too. My wife and I took them to some of her relatives that moved to California, so we took a trip to California. So I took my wife and three kids on a plane ride to California. We get off at LAX airport, and I let the children go through, and I let my wife go through, then I go through. As soon as I passed, the thing, bells went off, and horns were blowing, and everything else, you know. And my family's waiting for us to greet them, you know. Two guys grabbed me by the arm. Would you step back and go through again? So I stepped back, and I went through again. Now they really grabbed me and took me off to the side, you know. I says, what are you doing? What's wrong with me, you know? And my cousins out there, put them in jail. Put them, just, they're stupid, you know. So, we laugh about it all the time. But they took me to a little room, and they asked me to strip and everything else, you know. Yeah. I says, what are you looking for? I says, I don't have no pistols or guns or nothing, you know. You know, he says, well, you're ticking off the thing. I says, how about the shrapnel in my legs? So I says, I'll drop my legs here. I got over 100 pieces in my legs. So they put the thing up there, and that's what it was. Uh-huh. Yeah, but now things are more sophisticated.
I'm sure your kids remembered that, too.
It's that time when I come to them with their dad.
Well, you dealt with much worse interrogations than that, I know, too. And I want people to understand what the situation is here. So you're on this airplane that is barely making it, that is not going to make it. And there's a real chance you aren't going to make it. You're wounded severely. You can't get yourself out of this plane. So you needed your fellow crew members to save your life, right?
After they dragged me through from the tail of the ship into the radio room, which was like a cabinet, you know, so that they could talk. And you didn't have the noise in here in the radio room, you know. So when I was on the floor, they looked at my wound and everything. They put sulfur powder on it, made compresses on it, you know, wrapped it real tight and gave me morphine and other sedatives. It was in the first aid kit, you know. And I was awake.
What was going through your head?
I had no idea. I don't. The thing is, as things were happening, and I'd say to myself, all I was doing there was trying to remember what's going on, unconsciously, yeah. You know, observing everything that's going on. And that's why I have such a vivid picture of it. What's ahead, I don't know. It's just happening there. You're looking at it, and I remember it, you know.
So you couldn't walk. You couldn't bail out yourself, and the captain's given the order to bail out, right?
Yeah, the captain gave the order to bail out, and they took care of me first. And they got me over to the door, put the chute on me, popped the chute in the floor, and put it in my arms and tossed me out. I just didn't take long for the chute to open up, you know. Quite a jolt, by the way.
Well, yeah, so they actually pulled the ripcord before they pushed you out of the plane. So then it's opening immediately when you pop out of that plane.
Yeah. It was happening. I wasn't thinking about it. My mind was just recording it, that's all.
So you had a pretty long way down to the ground. Were you conscious? Were you looking around you? What did you see?
At first, I thought I was going up. You know, and honest to God, I said, geez, this thing's going up, you know. And then all of a sudden, the ground started coming up to me, meet me, you know. And then there were dwellings around the area, and there was farms and everything else. So I remember that, you know. And then after I landed, I know where it was, you know. And I have one member of my crew that went over later, many years later, and he documented where our plane went down. Then when we had reunions, I had another fellow brought his video camera, and they all talked around, and we have a video of that, you know.
While all this was going on, did the thought enter your mind that you might not wake up another day, that this might be it for you?
No. I didn't think about death then, you know. I just was observing what's happening at now. That was the only thing I was interested in.
And what happened when you hit the ground?
I tumbled like a jackrabbit. I tumbled down the hill.
Yeah.
A few steps like that, because it was on a little hill like this, and I just boom, 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 boom. You know. I know their instructions were to hold your feet up and let you get, but easier said than done, you know, especially if you're wounded, you know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even think of that, you know.
Well, and I've talked to some POWs who who tried to hide or avoid capture. And most of them, you know, maybe they lasted a few hours, but they were eventually captured. And in your case, there wasn't much you could do because you couldn't move unless you dragged yourself with your arms, huh?
Yeah. I had no motion at all. I had to be on a stretcher or a bed somewhere, and that was it, you know.
Who found you? What did they say to you?
There were two German members of the Wehrmacht, like sad sacks. The civilians were coming in a distance, and they came close enough that I saw they had pitchforks and that in their hands, and that. And the two Germans fired a couple rounds, and they went back to where that house was that they eventually took me anyway, you know. Took me to the farmhouse where the Hitler Youth took him again.
So that night you spent the night in a cow barn, unable to move, guarded by two members of the Hitler Jugend. I can't imagine what that felt like. And even after they got you to a hospital, you don't know how much they really want to take care of you. You don't speak their language. And there was a real fear that you might lose your leg.
Well, I said when I lay was on the table and the flying nun that was just attending to the doctor, you know, at the thing in the table wasn't more than 3 feet wide and about belly high, you know, where I was laying on, maybe chest high or right here, and none was looking straight at my face, you know. I don't know what the procedure was, but I know they put a container on my nose and told me to count, and I remember counting to about 100.
You wanted to know if they were going to cut off your legs, so you motioned?
The nun was beside me, and I made motions with my hand if they were going to amputate, and the nun says, nine. I already knew because my mother spoke German, so different words that I didn't know from that, you know. And I just had no thoughts more about somebody's taking care of me, do with me what thou wilt.
But when you came to after that operation, what was the first thing you did?
Well, I took my hand, started my hip, and went down the side and see if I still had a leg. Because I thought the Germans were historically, amputations were the easiest way out. So that's what had happened, and I went down my leg, and it's like that, and they patched me up the best they could, and I don't know what the drugs they used on me or anything else, but they comforted me enough that a couple of days later, I was taken on a train to the interrogation center in Dulag Luft for down flyers.
So they didn't amputate. They took care of you. So here you have a situation. A, the civilians basically have a lynch mob and they want to take you out, and these German guards shoot their gun in the air to save your life, and then these medical professionals save your leg and get you fixed up. Looking back now, how does that make you feel to know that these people on the other side of the war, your enemies, took such good care of you?
Well, I think later finding out that because we had been taking care of down German flyers, bringing them to the United States and taking care of them, they know what they got in the United States, German flyers here in the country, what good service they were getting, you know. I think that reflected back to us where we didn't get treated as miserable. How the good Lord took care of me, brought me back home. There's things that you're going to experience in your life that are very traumatic, but there are more things that are happy. So you don't dwell on the sadness and everything else. There's solutions to all things like that, sadness, you know, and some good might even come out of them, you know. But don't dwell on it because you'll ruin yourself. And my prayers were to make me healthy and return to my family, and dedicate myself to that, you know. I told the dear Lord, if you let me get out of this predicament that I'm in, I'll never complain in my life. And I've done that.
And he kept doing that until his final breath in 2015 at the age of 91. Frank Kravitz's book, 11-2, is linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. So those are the stories of just three of the more than 300 Americans shot down over Merseburg 75 years ago. Just imagine what stories we never got to hear. Another reason to engage the veterans in your life and encourage them, when they're comfortable, to share some of their stories with you. I promise you'll understand even more clearly those four words we close with every time. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.